We've been talking about a number of stocks that are moving this morning, and I just want to get your take on the general market action. We're coming off record highs. We were talking with previous guests about how the VIX is at a low and suppressed level. We haven't had a 5% correction in the market in some time here. And we're also sitting on, I think, the fourth highest set of record highs for any year going back 100 years. So how do you make sense of all this?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, thanks for having me today, guys. Always appreciate being on here. And I think, first of all, you're hitting on a lot of it. And the pattern I expect to continue for the rest of the year. And that is this constant message of conflicting numbers or conflicting outlooks. You know, we come off, as you said, record highs in the NASDAQ on Friday in a day where we have disappointing job numbers. We all expect bad numbers out of China in terms of exports, and they come up with good numbers overall. So now the main overall theme continues to be, what's the Fed going to do? And every data point we get on, it seems like people have a conflicting view of what they're going to do, or tapering's going to start sooner, tapering's going to start later. And I think for the viewers right now, it's more about, okay, just, you know, just try and shut out some of the noise as much as you can. Stick with some stocks that you think are good over time. If you want to play volatility, this is a nice volatility environment in the fact that it's not huge one way or the other, but we do get a lot of intraday or intra-week volatility where you are getting some opportunities to play the volatility from that point of view. So as I said, I really expect this pattern to continue for the rest of the year. I don't think we're going to get any clarity. You know, the Delta virus being in and out, we just stopped the extra money for assistance checks for people. So again, all these continuing points that make you scratch your head on which way the economy is really going, while at the same time we set new highs, I don't see a reason why that stops in the short term.
JJ, weigh in on this debate. We've been talking all morning long about President Biden potentially this week announcing his decision on Fed chair. Handicap this for investors. If Jay Powell is reappointed, where does the market go? And then conversely, if he's not reappointed, where does the market go?
Well, hey, Brian, I think, you know, the first thing is, if you look at the history of the stock market, what is it? It's about the known having less of a dramatic effect than the unknown. We know Jay Powell. We know what to expect. He's been pretty good in, you know, agree or disagree with the decisions he's made overall. He telegraphs his decisions pretty well to the market, in my opinion, about what he is going to do, when things are going to happen. Takes a very conservative approach in terms of moving. You know, I know a lot of people would like him to move a little bit more aggressively right now. But he does tend to take that, I'm going to let the numbers tell me what to do. And, you know, the argument has been maybe a little bit late at times. With that said, we know what we have. And so the market tends to, you know, maybe we sell off a little bit based on him being reappointed. My guess is, no matter who the other person is, no matter how smart they may be, I would expect the market to sell off a little bit more if somebody else is appointed, only because it's a completely unknown commodity and the market gets used to a Fed chair after, you know, 6 months to a year, and how they operate, how they communicate with the market and what we can expect. And so, again, there's just like, it's almost like having a new boss or something like that. There's a transition time that you go through with uncertainty. And so the market goes through uncertainty with a new Fed chair, Brian. So I would expect that will add more volatility if it is not Jay Powell.
Yeah, I remember him getting off to a couple of stumbling starts there. Those pressers were kind of brutal in the beginning. But I want to shift directions to the bond market. The 10-year T-note yield, I'm looking on the Wi-Fi Interactive. It is up 5 basis points. And I've been showing this chart. I don't know if you can see this, but basically it looks like the yields, you know, inversely, the bonds are kind of coiling here. You take a look at a year-to-date chart, we see this consolidation. And if yields break potentially above 1.4%, I got to think that's going to be it's going to gain some momentum. We're going to hit stop losses in bonds. And I'm just wondering where you see bond yields going next under a couple different scenarios.
Well, I think, as I said, you know, without us doing anything by the end of the year, we can get to 1.5, maybe a little bit above that. I just don't know what the stimulus is to get us too far away from this 1.5-ish area on the upside and this 1.25 area on the downside. So I would expect this, as you said, that coil, I think, is a good way to say it. We may spring out, and it looks like getting a breakout just to sell off. Or if we go down, look like we're going to sell off on the yield only to come back. You know, just like everything else, the punch that knocks you out is the one you don't see. So if something happens between now and the end of the year, it can drive us either way. But all other things being equal, I don't see why we go out of this range.
JJ, I talked to Kathy Wood on Friday. She told me she's still looking for Tesla stock to hit about $3,000 a share. Currently, it's at $757. It was interesting to me to see your TD Ameritrade clients selling Tesla in August. Why do you think they were doing that?
Well, you know, actually, Brian, they sold it 2 months in a row. They sold it in July and August, which I think is very interesting overall. A couple of reasons. Number one, because when Tesla gets back above 700, it seems to bring people out as sellers a little bit more. As you know, covering that stock every day, that 700 level just seems to be some sort of a magnet on the stock. Seems like when we've gotten over it recently, we go back. When we get under it, we come back to it. And so I think that that's part of the reason. Also, in the EV space, you know, you guys just had a segment on here before I went on. The competition has heated up so significantly over the last year. You see Ford and GM as two stocks that our clients were actually buying, Brian, as they sell Tesla. So what does that tell me? That we know Ford and GM are really good at distributing cars. But can they get the cars to distribute, so to speak, in terms of the electrical vehicle space? Tesla obviously has better battery technology that gives them an advantage over others. But I think what we're really looking for is, or clients are really looking for, is Ford and GM to continue to pick up their game and this to become a much more competitive space over time. Very interesting that we also had Tesla last month talk about, you know, getting into the electric game down in Texas, et cetera. So maybe they're looking for other areas to grow their business, which is fantastic overall. But again, I think from a what people are looking at from the car distribution, car making point of view, they see Ford and GM having a opportunity longer term to make some strides there.
Yeah, Ford up 48% this year, GM up 18%, Tesla up 7%. Thanks for stopping by, JJ. That's JJ Kinahan, TD Ameritrade Chief Market Strategist.
Urban mobility upstart Archer said today it has received G1 certification from the FAA. It essentially sets the path for Archer to begin commercial operations. The news comes a few weeks after Archer cut its valuation by 38% ahead of its upcoming debut on the New York Stock Exchange. Joining us for more is Archer co-founder and co-CEO Brad Adcock and former United Airlines chairman and CEO Oscar Munoz, who is a board member at Archer. Good morning to you both. Brad, let me start with you on the news here. Big on the G1 certification from the FAA. What does that essentially allow you to do? And then where you launch and when does that happen?
Yeah, good morning. So as you're probably aware, we're working to design, manufacture, and operate electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. So as you're probably well aware, in the U.S., the FAA governs all the airspace federally. So what we're doing now is we're certifying our aircraft, say, to commercial aviation standards in order to bring this new transportation service to the market. Part of the process we're going through now with the FAA is to agree on a set of specific airworthiness and environmental standards so that our aircraft we're designing now can meet full FAA type certification as we get to market. The news from today of us the FAA accepting our G1 certification basis is a really important and fundamental step for us to pave the way in order for Archer to bring this new type of vehicle to market. We plan to use this in cities to help alleviate traffic. The first two launch cities we've announced are Miami and Los Angeles.
And Oscar, key to this story here for Archer is that United Airlines has placed orders for $1 billion worth of the company's products. Why do you think United is making that bet?
You know, I wasn't part of that decision making, but knowing how historically we've made this, there's always been a focus on customers. And one of the last sort of, you know, phases we've been trying to accomplish is how do we reduce stress level for folks? And the commute from your home to the airport has always been one of those issues. So the concept falls along the customer centricity line. I suspect at United, having bought a lot of aircraft with the team there, there was thorough vetting. And I guarantee you, for airline experts, simplicity and reliability is what the Archer team has put together with hundreds and hundreds of years of experience in this space, on the eVTOL space. And so I suspect it's safe, it's reliable, it's really going to be an affordable method of transportation, and it's really going to be cool for the customer. So it's a fun, innovative new thing, and I'm excited to join. I haven't quite joined the board yet, just for clarification, but I hope to do that fairly soon.
Oh, Brett, this does look pretty exciting. I'm going through some of your promotional materials here, your brochures, and you're talking about scaling. And one of the lines here says you expect to work with aligned development partners to build high throughput vertiports that can accommodate hundreds of takeoffs and landings per hour, hundreds. And I'm thinking about the noise. How do these compare to helicopters, and what are you doing to kind of reduce any potential noise pollution?
It's a great question. I mean, noise is a really important gating mechanism for us to be able to operate, do operations inside of cities. And as you know, we're developing a vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, so we can basically fit the aircraft right into the fabric of cities. And noise is a really important area for us to ultimately drive down. Noise in a helicopter today is in a lot of ways limiting their ability to operate in a big way across cities. Helicopters are just too noisy today. They have very loud turbine engines. The tips at the rotors are spinning close to the speed of sound, generating a considerable amount of noise from a helicopter. We have very different dynamics here for our aircraft. The first is we have electric motors that spin much quieter. And two is we have much smaller propellers that spin at much lower tip speeds that result in considerably less noise. So say at like 2,000 feet above ground level, which we'll be flying at, we'll be virtually inaudible flying overhead, so we don't disturb anybody on the ground. And this is really important as we start scaling up operations in a big way across cities. We don't want to annoy the local neighbors and the neighborhoods. And moving to a fully electric version of this allows us to basically reduce the noise considerably versus what's out there today.
And then, Brett, for those watching this that are very intrigued by this technology, really like it, understand it, can get on board with it, can you just explain to them the valuation cut that you recently took? Why did you do it, and what does that mean for your path moving forward?
Sure. So as you're probably aware, we're going into our shareholder vote next week, so it's a really important time for us. We decided to ultimately reduce the valuation of the business into this as a way to help give ourselves the ability to have better attraction for shareholders as we're coming out of the gate here. I think it's really important for us to not only trade really well, but also be able to attract some of the best investors in the world. I think the valuation we're setting here as we're going into the public markets is highly attractive. If you look at different areas of, like, say, hard tech, even eVTOL, electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles, I think the valuation of where Archer's entering at is highly attractive for investors. And I think today's news, like, really speaks to that. I think, we're one of the only companies in the world that has received, to our knowledge, the G1 certification basis. And we're working through now moving this, with the FAA as we approach commercial operations. We think the valuation here is highly attractive for folks. And hopefully we can produce a really large business over time.
Oscar, I was thinking back this morning before the segment. I think the last time I actually saw you in person was a New York City event in 2017. Obviously, a different time for the aviation industry. How long do you think the industry will take to recover from the pandemic? I mean, there's just been so much change the past year and a half, given everything that has happened.
Well, you know, that's a loaded question. There's so many factors, right? I mean, I think demand, you've seen demand peak over the summer, and it's trailed off here in the third quarter. Business travel is the big key instrument. The debate of return to the office and whether people are going to be traveling or not continues to debate. So I think all of those things above, plus the economic sort of burden that all the airlines have taken with regards to the situation, it'll take a while. I think financially it'll take a while, but I know Again, just knowing the United story, I mean, I think we're the first to get back to a sort of a profitable level and projecting that going forward. So it's going to take a little while, but I think more importantly, the focus on customers, the focus on service, and the focus on reaching all the different parts of the world are going to be key. And this Archer investment that they've made and the concept, I mean, it's such a cool, fun, innovative thing. We're so excited about it. I mean, just think about it. No stress from your home to the airport. For all of us to travel all the time, that's just going to be a sad thing. And this is safe, reliable, and really a practical approach to this. So we are very excited. I'm excited to join the team in a little bit.
Yeah, I think we could all use faster travel to the airport. But we got time for one more. And I just want to ask you, you've had a little bit of time here. Sazi sent me some of your other projects. You are on a number of boards. And Oscar, I just want to ask you, what are you doing in your spare time here? Anything that you want to throw out?
No, you know, this is the Archer story as well. It's kind of an interesting part of your career to be in because I get to pick and choose who and what I want to do. And this was one of the cool things. But I'm also involved in my philanthropies. There's a really cool health tech company that I'm about to announce that I've been involved with. I'm with Fidelity at CBRE, Univision. And so it's, you know, they're my Latino influence, my health issues and how I'm focusing, aviation and customers, the Archer conversation and technology. So yeah, stay real busy with a lot of things. And so it's exciting and fun. And, you know, Brett and Adam are doing an amazing job of putting if you think of the group of people that they put together to build this thing, it's just really exciting to see what their future holds.
Yeah, the show doesn't look like retirement, Oscar, but good to see you keeping busy. Please do come back. We'll talk about that tech company that you're getting ready to launch with. In the meantime, Archer co-founder and co-CEO Brett Adcock and former United Airlines chairman CEO Oscar Munoz. Good to see you both. Congratulations on the news this morning. We'll talk to you soon.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. I'm Jared Blickery. Didi stock up 30% off of the lows only a few weeks ago. And we're going to talk about it, all the actions from the PBOC to the local Beijing government, which may be taking over the company. And for that, we're going to bring in Brad Gastworth. He is a Wedbush Securities Chief Technology Strategist. And Brad, when this stock debuted at IPO'd, I think it was only 2 days later that the Chinese government came out and just slammed it. And I think that sent a message to investors, but it's been popping recently. Can you tie this together? Is the worst over potentially as they look for their new owners, basically the state coming in and taking them over?
Yeah, Jared, you you hit it on the head. I mean, first of all, I think Beijing didn't really want Didi to become a public company trading here in the United States. And I think that by itself started the precedent of the perception, at least by Beijing, that Didi was not going to pay attention or listen or to adhere to sort of the structure that, you know, the government wanted. And I think right off the bat, there's a bad taste in the mouth by actually not necessarily taking their advice and still listing here. And to your point, I mean, what the future holds a lot of interesting things, but, you know, clearly there's been reports that Chinese government is looking to get more investment or investment into the company. And, you know, it wouldn't be surprising to see, you know, more involvement by the country.
And Brad, how do you handicap potential delisting here? Is this something that is more than a 50% chance that it actually happens?
Yeah, and Brian, I mean, that is such a good question. It's hard to really, put a probability on it. I'd say 50% just because it's a coin flip is probably the right way to assess. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, with the rhetoric between the two nations really getting worse and worse, and I think when you look at what President Xi has been doing, he's been sending a message that, you know, look, he wants to take control back. Even though the government's always had control, there's been perception, at least from the U.S. investment community, that there was some autonomy in in these companies. And that's really far-fetched. I think from the beginning, you know, everybody had to understand that, you know, investing in Chinese companies listed abroad, they're still Chinese companies and the government can do what they want. So I think that risk has been now more realized and known. And I think, you know, is a delisting coming? That's a coin flip, but, you know, certainly it's a possibility, and it's maybe a better than a 50%.
I'm wondering what you think this does for the EM space overall. You think emerging markets and lots of countries around the world, we used to talk about the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China. But you know, you got to think that if you take an ETF like EEM, you look at the top spots, it's almost all Chinese tech. You got some other big giants in there like Samsung. But if you want to be an EM, how do you approach this now?
Yeah, and Jared, I mean, you're bringing up that. I think that's really one of the most important points here that I think, you know, people may be missing. And thanks for the question. I think in emerging markets, like the biggest country beneficiary here is probably India. You're having, you know, high growth, big population, and, you know, they also attract very strong talent on the technology side. So I think India is an interesting emerging market play. When you look at the indexes, I think indexes are tough because, you know, people really can put what they want in an index. That being said, for me, I like exposure in Southeast Asia. You're on port side, so you have access to water. Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, I think all of those countries will benefit over time. Bear in mind, the COVID situation is having a major impact in that region because the poorer countries are having harder times getting vaccinations. But I do like Southeast Asia. I see them as a net beneficiary. I think you'll see more going back into Latin America. As you sort of, or Jared, as you pointed out with the BRIC countries, it used to be talked about all the time, but I do think you're going to see more investment in Brazil. But ultimately, unfortunately, you'll see outflows continue for some time out of Chinese companies that are listed abroad. I think, these newer areas, and maybe Africa, but we're still a little bit too early in the frontier over there. I'd say those are the beneficiaries.
Is there one Chinese tech company that could survive this? Based on looking for one name that, you know, maybe they have the best contacts in the Chinese government, whatever the reason, that is not in the same boat as DT, and their stock might thrive on the other side of this.
I don't think there's not going to be one company that's going to make it different than all the other Chinese listed companies. I think what ultimately may happen is you might see a shift going into the Shanghai or going in listed A shares. I think you might see that take place on these companies. Because, I mean, if you look at what's happening in Hong Kong and even what China sort of did with Hong Kong, I mean, there's a lot of wild cards out here. But when I look at this world, and by the way, I mean, if you look at China, I mean, it's still an amazing open-ended growth opportunity. It's just I find it uninvestable from a U.S. perspective right now because you just don't know what that risk will be. So, you know, I'll wake up one morning and there could be more regulation, a delisting, something maybe being blocked, but I won't wake up one morning with a really positive thing from President Xi saying that he's giving control back to the companies. So I find the downside risk is very significant. The upside surprise is not there. And to me, that makes, you know, outflows likely for some time.
Yeah, you got to think that we're still in the beginning stages here and seeing all those stocks chopped in half and still basically in the bottom end of their trading ranges. We're going to be keeping an eye on this. And Brad, thanks for stopping by. Thanks for stopping by. Brad Gasworth, the Wedbush Securities Chief Technology Strategist.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. Microsoft President Brad Smith out with an updated version of his best-selling book, Tools and Weapons, The Promise of Peril of the Digital Age Today. The paperback edition gives readers new insight into Microsoft's investigation of the SolarWinds hack in December of last year. Let's bring in Brad Smith himself for much more on the book. Brad, it's always good to talk to you. In the book, you describe the SolarWinds attack as a moment of reckoning, where you say that it illustrated the degree to which tech can be both a defensive and an offensive tool as well. What specifically was it about the nature of the attack that made you realize that? And ultimately, what has that meant in terms of Microsoft's defense against some of these hacks?
Well, it was an attack that was extraordinarily sophisticated. It's been attributed by governments around the world at this point to the Russian Foreign Intelligence Agency. And what it specifically did is it infiltrated the software supply chain of a particular company, in this case, SolarWinds. And then by installing malware in one of that company's updates, it reached tens of thousands, roughly 17,000 companies around the world. And you know, it was in many ways, I think, an act of recklessness in terms of the form of the attack. And we just have not seen something like that impact successfully so many major governments and tech companies before. And so it's been, I think, as events have had it, as we spell out in our book, a galvanizing moment, not just for the tech sector, but for the White House and for governments around the world, rightly so.
You've already committed to spend $20 billion over the next 5 years to build up defenses for cybersecurity. I know you've been working closely with the Defense Department, with the Biden administration. As we see the nature of these attacks step up, what do you see as the role of the private sector as well as the government in trying to wage against these attacks that feel like they're really elevating on a weekly basis in terms of the nature of them?
I think for those of us in the private sector and in the business community, there are three really important roles. The first is for the tech sector itself. It's for companies like Microsoft and others to strengthen our defenses, to strengthen security protection, to expand security services. I think the second is really across the economy and across the private sector, and that's basically to put these protections to work. Every organization, whether it's a nonprofit, a government, or a business, is going to need to up its own protection. And in some cases, that just means using what it has already purchased. In some cases, it may mean more. And then finally, I think there's a broad cybersecurity skilling challenge. It's a challenge because there's a shortage across the country and around the world. It's a challenge for the education community, for community colleges, for services like LinkedIn that Microsoft operates. But ultimately, it's a challenge we all need to meet. We're all going to invest. We're all going to need to invest in more skilling and then more hiring of cybersecurity professionals.
Yeah, and that's, I guess that's kind of the tricky part in putting this all together, right? Because, you know, the SolarWinds attack seemed like it had been going on a lot longer than people realized. And, you know, $20 billion seems like a lot of money, but when it's spread out over 5 years coming from just Microsoft, obviously it's going to take a big partnership here in private and public. But $150 million to help the U.S. government update and protect their own kind of systems as well. I mean, but what more push do you think needs to happen maybe here from the government, given the fact that we are seeing a lot of these attacks rise from Russia and other countries, the concentration there? What's it maybe going to take more in protecting Americans and American companies, maybe on the public side?
Well, I think you make a great point, and it's really a lot of what inspired my co-author, Carol Ann Brown, and I to add more material to this book in this particular chapter. It starts with a better understanding of the problem. And that requires that more companies and others share more information broadly with each other. In some ways, I think it's even appropriate to use this week, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, to reflect on one of the lessons of the 9/11 Commission. It was a failure of intelligence sparked in many ways by a culture where people only had a way of sharing knowledge, information, when they felt there was a need to know. And the 9/11 Commission said that needed to shift to a need to share. That is something for all of us. I do think it will require some acts of Congress. That's another part of the story in the book, how this went from the tech sector to the White House to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to need laws that I think mandate information reporting to the right part of the government at the right time in the right way. And then I think it is a whole of society moment. And that was really the watershed, I think, that we saw at the White House last month, bringing together not just tech companies, but community college leaders, energy company CEOs, insurance and banking executives. We all are going to need to take new steps. And as you put it, we need to do it together.
Brad, one of the other things that you've been exploring throughout the pandemic really is about the access to broadband, something that you had pushed pre-pandemic, but we really did see this divide, especially with more and more people at home with remote work. As a company, how have you been thinking about your role in trying to expand access to internet? Obviously, Microsoft employees largely in areas where it's readily available, but it feels like that conversation was there at the beginning of the pandemic. Now it's kind of taken a step back.
Well, the first thing I would say is I'm reluctant to say that anything as terrible as a pandemic has a silver lining. But one thing that COVID-19 did do has caused us all to see something that was in front of our eyes to which we weren't paying enough attention. And that's the broadband divide. That's why we've been banging this drum for several years saying, you know, look, broadband's the electricity of the 21st century, and the people who don't have it are basically living in the 1990s. The good news, in my opinion, is we are awakened as a society, really as a planet. We're seeing major commitments by the administration and Congress, including in the infrastructure bill, to take the kinds of steps that will be needed to close this gap. Certainly for Microsoft, we have multiple roles. It starts, frankly, with just great data analysis. We've provided what I think is now regarded as the preeminent map of the United States in terms of just enabling people to see who has broadband and who does not. But knowledge is just the beginning. You know, I think there are new partnerships with new technologies. With a company like SpaceX, we can look forward to, I think, a brighter future with low Earth orbiting satellites, with more partnerships with telecommunications companies. We have the wherewithal as a country to solve this problem in the next 4 years. And yeah, I would almost say shame on us if we fail to do it, because we're going to be leaving too many people behind in rural America, and especially underprivileged and racially diverse communities in urban America. And I just don't think our country can afford that.
Yeah, and I mean, as you talk about that gap, there's also the gap in terms of hybrid work in this pandemic that's been pretty evident as well. That's increased the role of platforms like Microsoft Teams. We've talked about Slack getting used as more people are working outside the office. I mean, how quickly does that side of the business become even more important the longer this drags on? And maybe, you know, if we never get back to the idea of a full return to normal and hybrid sticking around, I mean, talk to me about the growth that you've seen there.
Well, we obviously have seen tremendous growth since the pandemic started in March of 2020. In many ways, we've seen, you know, services like Teams, you know, explode. We've seen broadband usage, you know, double in the course of a couple of months in 2020. And I think there are many aspects of this that will be here to stay. Perhaps not everything in every way. One of the things we talk about in one of the new chapters in our book is really how we can learn from World War II and what persisted and what abated after the war ended. I think the encouraging word is really to recognize that there is a blended future that creates more opportunities and more flexibility, probably for all of us. And it's not just, you know, working from home, but that is one important aspect. It's the opportunity to consult with a doctor via a telehealth service rather than having to trek, you know, to a physical office every time you want that kind of consultation. It's the opportunity for a sick child to attend school from home with a broadband connection, or for people to stay connected during a snow day. So I think we're going to have a future that basically puts, just say, think of video, interactive video, next to what we all grew up with the telephone. We could go visit family and friends, or we could call them on the phone, and our experiences were better because of it. Now we have video that opens the door to much richer interaction like we're having with this conversation, but now it's open to everybody, including in meetings with their employer and their team.
Brad, I'm curious to get your thoughts on what is playing out in China right now, because Microsoft's Word, Excel, PowerPoint recently named among a group of apps that have been accused of misleading or infringing on user privacy. And I know you had a conversation recently with an official, one of the regulators over in China. What have you gleaned from that conversation, from conversations you've had about the intention of the most recent crackdown? And ultimately, what does it mean about the way in which Microsoft operates in the country? It is one of very few tech companies that have a big presence there.
Yeah, and I, you know, was able to meet last week with the Chinese Minister for Industry and Information Technologies. They put out a statement after the meeting. Yeah, I would say two things. One is, you know, there is, in my view, the real need for clarity and stability in the broader technology relationship between China and the United States. I think part of that needs to come from China. Part of it needs to come from Washington, D.C. Clearly, there are going to be guardrails, and we need guideposts. So there's a mutual understanding of where the two governments want to see American technology companies play a role. Yeah, our view is that services like, you know, Word and Windows and productivity and the like, yeah, have an appropriate role to play on a global basis. And there are other services we have, say like facial recognition and certain AI services, where I don't think either the Chinese or U.S. governments are going to want us to necessarily be involved. I think that there is a real need for conversation about how we can play a role, how we need to play a role in China, so that American multinationals that have presences in China can use our cloud there just like they use it everywhere else. And I think there's an urgent need to talk about how we can put technology to work globally, including in China, to help reduce carbon emissions, and how we ensure that a global basic research community that operates in certain scientific fields can, and in an appropriate way, should use common technology. But we need to get to specifics. You can see from my list, having broad conceptual conversations, which is natural in the new administration, is the right place to start. But as we look to 2022 and the second year of the administration, it will be time to go from generalities, principles, and dive into specifics.
Well, we hope to keep the conversation going with you, Brad. Always good to have you on the show. Brad Smith, president of Microsoft, joining us on his new updated book. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Time for our startup spotlight. One industry that's getting back on its feet from COVID is the $70 billion wedding industry. And according to industry research firm Wedding Report, the number of weddings this year has already exceeded or already back to pre-pandemic levels. So we want to talk about some of the dynamics at play here, what we could expect going forward in the industry, and who better to talk to than Vishal Joshi. He is the co-founder and CEO of Joy. It's a wedding planning platform. And Vishal, it's good to see you. I guess just tell us some of the trends that you're seeing on your platform, how many people are planning weddings and how that compares to just 6 months ago.
Shala, we have seen fantastic growth, and we are seeing like almost 130% year-over-year growth. And if you go back even further 6 months, it's 250% growth. So we are seeing a lot of people come in. Like for instance, just last month, we had 2.6 million guests on Joy, which is almost double from 6 months back.
Delta variant, I guess, how big of a factor has that been within the industry? Because I think we all know couples who have gotten married over the last several weeks or are planning to get married over the next couple months and are worried about the case numbers that we're seeing. Are you seeing weddings either postponed or canceled as a result of that?
We have seen very little of weddings getting postponed or canceled at this point in time. We clearly saw a lot of weddings do get postponed and canceled last year. Over 60% of them did get canceled and postponed. But now they are coming back. Like 97% of the guests that we surveyed said they are willing to attend the weddings now. And over 60% of all the couples are having weddings with over 100 guests. So we're seeing that weddings are happening now, but we will see that next year perhaps is significantly bigger. And so we're probably going to see 2022 as the biggest year in wedding industry because some shift at the very beginning happened due to Delta.
What about people, just the availability of some of these venues? I know I've talked to people that were recently engaged and they're looking out 2022, yeah. 2023 at this point, they're getting married on a Friday or even a Monday because the demand is just massive here because of the built up due to the pandemic. Is this something that you're seeing being a factor in the industry, at least for the next 1 to 2 years?
Absolutely. That you have hit it on the head. This is such a big issue that venues have been booked Fridays, Mondays. I have heard Thursdays now, which is insane. So this year was already jam-packed. Next year is going to be even more crazy. And I think that like even the year after, we are probably going to see a good amount of surge. We've also seen people add a virtual component because of these venue restrictions. So we are seeing over 40% of couples continue to do virtual weddings, in a sense, keep a virtual component into their wedding. And that is also something which is staying steady. And we built a lot of technology last year to allow for these virtual weddings to happen. And that is continued to pay off for next couple of years.
And what does that technology look like? I guess, what are you doing in order to assist some of these couples who are trying to integrate that virtual component into the wedding?
Well, you see, as pandemic hit, people realized that technology was a very important aspect, because if you think about it, people cannot even communicate with 150 guests that they have in any other way beyond invitations and save the dates. So Joy provides this communication tools. So the first thing that happened was that people used these communications tools and sent millions and millions of messages. We built a thing called Change the Date, which was a play on Save the Date. And people use that to send things out. We built virtual wedding invitations, which included information about Zoom weddings and stuff. Then we integrated with Zoom and YouTube Live and Google Meet and all these platforms so that right inside your wedding website, you can actually see your virtual wedding being played. So all of those things and a bunch of other technologies like announcement banners, but mostly communication stack, because that became so, so important.
I know you just announced $20 million funding round, bringing your total funding to just over $46 million. How do you plan to deploy that capital? And guess what do your expansion plans look like for Joy?
So we so far built all these different tools and technologies to remove wedding planning stress. We've built wedding websites, save the dates, invites, planning tools, bunch of these things which all flow in very beautifully together. And so now what we are doing is that we are taking that step ahead, and we just recently launched All-in-One Wedding Registry. This product has seen so phenomenal growth. It has grown double digit week over week for the last 6 months. It has grown like double each time, like 100% growth in month over month. So we are doubling down and making wedding registry an amazing experience. And after that, we will go down and focus on taking Joy to several different countries. It's already being used in over 100 countries, but we have paid a lot more attention to the United States, and we'll probably in coming years expand into different countries. And then beyond that would be bringing Joy to all your life events beyond weddings, like birthdays and bar mitzvahs and baby showers and everything.
Michelle, when you're looking to expand overseas, I guess, how are you identifying regions or countries, areas that are most attractive to you? What are some of those components that you're looking for?
We, Shauna, mostly most of our decisions are driven by our couples. We see a very natural pull in so many different countries. And as people start using Joy more and more in those countries, we start seeing them ask for more and more features. Like we launched Registry just a few months back, and we have people who are coming in from several different countries, UK as an example, who basically want us to support Great British Pound and products selling over there. Canadian people are asking for that. Australian people are asking for that. So it is very clear sign that Joy is being used in all these different places, which is what we usually use. Almost all of our decisions are driven by where the couples naturally pull us. And they are currently pulling us in all those countries and many, many other English-speaking countries.
Michelle Joshi, co-founder and CEO of Joy. Thanks so much for taking the time. We wish you all the best. We want to continue this conversation. For that, we want to bring in Dr. Matisse Lachwayo-Davis, Director of Health for the City of St. Louis. And Doctor, it's good to see you again. Congratulations on your new position. Let's just start with booster shots, the timing of this, a difference that it will potentially make. I guess from your perspective, how significantly do you think booster shots will help slow the spread of the Delta variant?
Well, the data for booster shots is very compelling. We believe that it will improve immunity, confer folks with a higher level of antibody response, and hopefully even contribute to the overall immunity in the memory B cells that aid in protection against COVID. So the data is very compelling. That is true. However, it's not just about that data in isolation. As you know, it is a complex decision to be able to roll out these boosters and do so in a way that's equitable, not just for us here, but also abroad.
When it comes to booster shots, I think a lot of people are wondering if, say, if they got Moderna the first round, can they get a booster of Pfizer or vice versa? Or what happens if you got J&J? Can you get one of these mRNA vaccines as a booster? What's your answer to that?
Well, the only thing that we have data for, and let's be clear, we don't even know if this is going to be approved by that September 20th date. We expect Pfizer to have this data available for review by the 17th. Moderna is unlikely to be able to make that deadline. and no word yet from when that will be available from Johnson & Johnson. So it's likely that this will be a step-by-step approach. But we should only advise folks to get boosters the way that data is presented. And in this case of Pfizer, who hopefully will have robust data, which we won't know until September 17. So I'm not really willing to say anything for or against it until that time. We should review that data. Then to do it the way that it has been looked at. And in this case, it would be a boost. If you got Pfizer, the booster should be with Pfizer. If you got Moderna, you need to wait to see what the data says around that. There's currently no data available that supports mixing and matching of vaccines, although that is being looked at.
Doctor, let's talk about what's going on in your city of St. Louis, because now you are the director of health for the city. I guess talk to us. I know Missouri as a state, the ICU bed capacity right around 85%. But what more specifically are you seeing in your city today?
I mean, what we see now is numbers at a high, at an all-time high. We're seeing that in hospitalizations. And unfortunately, that is reflected in deaths, much higher than we were at the beginning of the summer. We know that comes from this Delta variant that has a much higher transmissibility. And we also know that the vaccine is our best form of protection. And unfortunately, we have not been able to reach herd immunity in this community in the U.S. in general, which is also making this very difficult, because predominantly what I'm seeing in my hospital, this is being mirrored across hospitals in the city, in the state, is that hospitalized cases and deaths overwhelmingly in the unvaccinated. And so that is where we are. And it is exceedingly concerning.
And there's so many unknowns right now, especially when children are going back to school. They started going back to school over the last several weeks. More and more are entering school over the next couple of weeks. A lot of them are in the age group where you can't yet get the vaccines under the age of 12. What do parents, what do teachers, what do guardians need to do at this point to best protect that vulnerable population?
Well, the best form of protection we have right now is for the vaccine. So anyone who is eligible to get the vaccine should really, especially in what I consider such a critical component of the community, these are our educators and our children who are so vulnerable. Those that are able to get the vaccine should. Children who cannot get the vaccine, their best chance of staying healthy is to be around other vaccinated folks. Kids who are of the age of the ability to mask should be masking indoors. All teachers should be masking indoors, as has been recommended by the CDC. But most importantly, we need resources available, especially to low-income school regions, to make sure they have the capacity to create safe environments for both their teachers and their children. Social distancing, hand washing, adequate ventilation, and those types of mitigation strategies that will help to keep both their teachers and children safe. But lastly, I believe that in order for us to be able to stay ahead of this, we need to have the capacity to test folks and do so rapidly. So rapid testing needs to be something that should be made available to all schools and scaled up immediately.
And is that something that you're focused on in the city of St. Louis?
You know, I don't start the job until October 18th. I'm chomping at the bit to do so, but absolutely, this is no longer a one-pronged approach to addressing this. It is a multifaceted approach. It requires a deep commitment towards vaccinations, making sure vaccines are accessible to all those who want them. It requires addressing misinformation, but it also requires making sure that there's an equitable approach to keeping the citizens of the city safe. And that requires mitigation strategies and access to resources to be able to carry out those mitigation strategies. That's an all hands on deck approach. It's going to require me sitting down with local leaders, with our educational leaders, with our community leaders, and really hearing back from the community about what they need to be able to cross that threshold and do what it takes to protect themselves and their loved ones.
Dr. Mati Slachwayo-Davis, always great to get your perspective. Congratulations again on your new position as Director of Health for the City of St. Louis, and we look forward to speaking with you once you start that next month.